You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and broadcasting live today from New York, and New York City, Times Square, the world headquarters of Dow Global, one of our syndicators here, and very, very pleased to be here, and tip of the hat, and many thanks to them for the studio. Congressman Raul Grijalva is with us. He is the Congressional Progressive Caucus co-chair and U.S. Congressman from Tucson, the 7th District of Arizona. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
I'm very always honored and pleased to have you with us. Tell us what's going on with regard to the Progressive Caucus and or individual members of Congress or whatever it may be and the Occupy Wall Street movement, the 99% movement, the groups that are springing up around the country, your thoughts and what's going on with that?
Well, our initially when it started, you know, the Progressive Caucus indicated support for the occupiers, and we did so in saying that this is a legitimate expression of the frustration, a legitimate expression of free speech, and more importantly, a counterpoint to what has been the direction of policy and politics in this country for about a decade plus, and that the fact that people had taken to utilizing their free speech and to assembling peacefully was an indication that political leadership better start listening.
Yeah, and acting. It seems.
Acting exactly.
Any thoughts on what the none of these groups, a few of the groups have issued lists of demands, but, I mean, generally speaking, the main message seems to be things are not right, things are unfair, things are not working, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore, my word's not theirs. And,
yeah.
And it's up to you guys. I mean, you're a member of Congress, for example. It's up to you guys to pass the laws to make things right. So what would those be in your mind?
Well, I think the message, and I think I said the other day, there's some presumption, particularly in with the Republican leadership in Congress to say, or others to say for that matter, to say, well, we need a list of demands in order for us to know what they want. Well, if elected officials in Congress and the Republican leadership are looking for a prescription, one's not forthcoming because we have yet to issue a prescription from Congress as to how we rectify what I think is the central theme of these occupiers, and I might be wrong. It's an issue of fairness in a very large context. It's an issue of fairness, and I think that one way to begin to balance the scales again is for Congress to quit dithering around about the deficits and the super committee and where do we cut taxes more, how do we keep the policies that have got us in this economic hole, how do we continue to perpetuate those policies. You know, you got to break away from that. And I think what the occupiers, and I think and not only the people that are physically there, but I think a vast majority of the American people are telling Congress is to break out of this pigeonhole that we're in and to do something big and to do something for the American people. And what we sent to the super committee, what we found were four, what we believe, Progressive Caucus, based on the people's budget, $4 trillion worth of savings to be reinvested in jobs, to be reinvested in rebuilding America, to be reinvested in the programs that are vital to the future of this nation, not to mess with Social Security and Medicare. And we did that by rolling back some of the breaks that we've been given to corporate America as a consequence of the fiscal policies of the last 10 years, closing loopholes, assuring that Wall Street pays its fair share and that the very rich in this country pay their fair share. And then you begin to balance the scales. I think that's the fairness issues that's involved. We offered a contrast, and I mm-hmm. think that's what the occupiers are doing as well, asking for a contrast between what we have going now and where we need to go. And if you let the Bush tax cuts, which we shouldn't have extended for another year, expire when it's supposed to expire, that's an additional $3 trillion that you find.
Wow. It's amazing how much how much Bush gave away to the rich in his Congressman Grijalva, the prescriptions, the Progressive Caucus, my understanding is that you are used to be the or one of the largest caucuses in the House of Representatives.
Correct.
I don't know where you stand now relative to the Tea Party caucus since the 2010 election. Where is that?
We're about 77 members and coalescing very well this year.
You're still the largest caucus in Congress?
I believe we are.
Okay, then why, it seems like when the largest caucus in Congress says, hey, here's a plan that's going to work. We've had the CBO run the numbers. You know, we've had Jan Schakowsky on this program a number of times going through the numbers and the details with us and whatnot. And, I mean, she's just brilliant on this stuff.
Yeah.
And it works. It will work. The American people support it. The polling shows it. Why is it not being just grabbed onto by the rest of the Democratic Party and, for that matter, the administration, and run with as hard as they possibly can?
I think I said earlier, the pigeonhole of policymaking, which has been, okay, what do the special interests want? What does corporate America want? How do we design something to satisfy them first? And then we'll see we have enough to trickle down for the rest of the Americans
right. In
this country. And what the Progressive Caucus did with the people's budget, what we did in our fight for a public option in the health reform bill that if we had in now would have saved $61 billion a year. And what we're doing now with the issue that we're taking to the super committee in terms of where you can find money without hurting Americans, we did that. And we're going to continue to do that. I think it is, I facetiously say it's our effort to occupy the minds of Congress with something, an alternative.
Yeah.
And more than an alternative, I think the Democratic Party, and I think this administration should take what we're proposing not as some symbolistic gesture, but that it is a concrete policy. Mm-hmm. It is a fiscal direction that's going to make us solvent, balance the budget, and still take care of the needs of this country.
Yeah.
And I think now, particularly because of what's going on all across this country with the protests, that there is going to be more attention and more scrutiny to what we're proposing, and we welcome that scrutiny because we have validated it with CBO, independent economists, etc. And so we feel our numbers are solid.
No, your numbers are, and they will work, and they will solve these problems. It's going to make some very, very rich people squirm, and that's my last question to you. We've got 40-50 seconds here.
Okay.
And that is, are you, the 77 of you, concerned? I mean, these individual members of Congress, you know, a billionaire could easily knock out any of you, or maybe even all of you. Are you concerned about the upcoming elections, about Karl Rove's PAC and things like that?
The money, and you know, now that corporations are persons, you know, the money,
yeah.
the money is always, I had the toughest race I've ever had last time because there was a lot of outside money that came in.
Yeah.
Many of us anticipate that same kind of fight, but the counterbalance for us, and I'm very secure about that, is public opinion and public
mm-hmm.
support, and I think we have that. It's no accident that the Republican Party ranks me as one of the top 20 that they'd like to get.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's because of anything else other than the philosophy that we're promoting. And progressives expect challenges, but we feel that we have not only the angels on our side, but that we have popular support for our position.
You do. Congressman Raul Grijalva of Arizona, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Progressive Caucus's website, by the way, Grijalva, GRIJALVA.house.gov.
I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
Yep, broadcasting from New York City today. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nicole Gambar Zada is with us. She is a participant with Occupy San Francisco, OccupySF.com. Nicole, my apologies if I've mangled your name.
Oh, no, you did all right, Tom.
Oh,
good
great.
Morning.
Thanks good
for
morning.
Having me on the show today.
And thank you for joining us. And give us an update. OccupySF.com is apparently the website that has been put together for the San Francisco group. And, yesterday we were hearing reports from people in San Francisco throughout the program, and of course, it's been going on throughout the day of, you know, what the police had been up to the day before or the night before. Where does everything stand right now?
Right now, things are good. The camp is calm. The police never came last night. So there's a lot of news media out in the evening sort of expecting a police encounter. And it was good that, you know, it was just working groups last night. People were calm. We had a lot more people. After the 5 p.m. rally we held, we gained a lot more campers, which is great. That's what, you know, a lot of people come out, but the fact that you stay overnight is really, you know, more like holistic action.
Now, is this
still there, like after the, just for 1 hour?
Yeah, absolutely. Is this still basically on the sidewalks around City Hall? Is that where it's going on or where?
We're actually at Justin Herman Plaza. It's about two blocks down from the Fed on the Embarcadero.
Oh, okay.
So we're very visible. We're viewed right from the cars driving up the Embarcadero, and then it's just the Bay Bridge and the Bay.
The Justin Herman Plaza. And that's an area where, is that a public park?
Yeah, it's a public park. There's a beautiful space. It's palm trees. And it's the big thing is it's lighted at nighttime. Over at the Fed, it's kind of dark over there. But here at Justin Herman Plaza, there's tons of light at night. And it's just a really, really great space that we know that we can grow with and build with.
Has your group had any interactions with the office of the mayor or any of the or the police or any of the other agencies within the government that would have the power to either encourage you or, for that matter, to run you out?
Yeah, we actually had our legal team yesterday visit the mayor's office, and they spoke with the representation of the mayor, not directly with him himself. But they were, you know, wanting to work with us. They seemed a little flustered when we were there, like almost. I mean, I saw a video from that, and they seemed a bit, like, intimidated at the mayor's office. Of, what is it that you guys really want? But I think we handled that really well. And we're today petitioning for a permit. We realized, you know, it's an inherent right for us to be here covered under the Constitution, but we do want to work with city officials.
Right.
Because they have expressed their interest to help us.
That's good.
So
Gavin Newsom
want to go through that process.
Is still a mayor of San Francisco, isn't he?
No, he's not. It's Ed Lee.
Oh, okay.
The mayor.
Where did Gavin move on to, or was he not, or am I remembering?
He got elected. He got elected, I think, to the California government.
To the assembly? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So Mayor Lee, and is Mayor Lee a progressive also, relatively speaking?
He supported us.
Great.
But it's sort of the left.
Yeah. Oh, and Jacob tells me that Gavin's now the lieutenant governor of California. I should have known that.
Yeah, that's correct. Sorry. Yeah, he's the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And I have a feeling he's going to go a long way. In any case, the movement is there. It's solid. Things are going along. And OccupySF.com, the website, and the thing that I'm guessing you need most is people to show up.
Yeah, we need bodies. We need people there at nighttime to really just build our movement organically, make it grow. I mean, we're all about, you know, using a consensus-based system to make decisions. And, you know, with that, there's a lot, you know, for education. We need to educate each other and be an informed community and let everyone's voice be heard. So the more people, the more perspectives, the more it's, you know, a representation of the true, you know, democratic system. So we need the people to come join us. It's, you know, one of the greatest experiments in the history of the world, I feel. And we really, you know, need folks to come out. And also just, you know, if they can't come out, you know, donate whatever, an hour in the day to come out or just express your support. We also, you know, are always looking for help. Just energy needs right now are important, and medical supplies, mm-hmm. As well as like toiletries and things like that are still, you know, we're still on our basic needs
right now
as we grow.
Okay. Well, you know, we're talking to a lot of people in San Francisco on AM, I think it's 960, Green 960, yeah, AM 960 in San Francisco. So hopefully that will drive some folks your way and bring something to it. Are you in communication with the other Occupy groups around the country?
Yes, we're in communication with Occupy New York as well as L.A. and a little bit with Chicago. Mm-hmm. We need to follow up more on that. But we've actually been getting more contacts because we do a 10-minute segment on the radio station KPFA every day called Occupation America. And that's, you know, to update about occupies around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, you know, we've gotten a lot more resources for getting news at the other occupations just via email.
Sure.
And we've got a long list of phone numbers we still need to go through. You know, we've got the contacts there, but just the fact that the time aspect and the deadline for getting, you know, producing this segment is definitely, you know, we're going to be communicating hopefully by Skype, you know,
sure.
with all the occupiers that, you know, to get to that point.
That's great.
We have a projector up. But right now it's pretty much New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and also with Denver, we have some connections.
That is great. That is great.
We are talking as well there.
That's great. Your caller ID knocked out your last sentence. Nicole, we're out of time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Thanks so much for being with us. Was there something you wanted to say very quickly?
Yeah, just the fact that this is just not just another protest about issues. It's the whole deal. And we are asking people to join it.
Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Danny Glover spoke at the Occupy Oakland gig last night. Here's what Danny Glover had to say.
It has to be a revolution, an evolution, and transformation. We have to be the change that we want to see. And we're willing to stand up for that. Are we willing to stand up for that? Young and old, it's not only taking back our democracy, we have to remake it. We have to transform it. We have to build something better than that. That's what we have to do. And we have to be here tomorrow, the next day, the day after tomorrow, and the tomorrows after tomorrow. And not only to change it, but to ensure that its transformation is institutionalized.
There you go. Rob in Phoenix, listening on KPHX. Hey, Rob, thanks for calling, 866-987-THOM. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, Doug.
Go ahead.
So I heard you talking with Raul Grijalva, and I think kind of what everybody is kind of beating around the bush at is that the problem is the money and the politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like if you look deeply at all of our problems, you can trace it back to money influencing politicians.
Oh, we weren't beating around the bush about it.
That was the bottom line
at the end of the conversation.
If you watch C-SPAN, you see everybody, you know, everybody looking very proper and working for the people. But the problem is that they're working for the people behind the camera or the lobbyists. Mm. And it's not us. That's what all these protests in all the cities are. Congress is not working for us. And the thing is that there's a diverse amount of people there. There's Ron Paul supporters, there's Obama supporters, there's all kinds of different supporters. But the one thing we all have in common, and I've been tweeting and Facebooking all the Occupy groups, and, you know, let's start with something. It's not going to solve all the problems, but it is a basic problem that we all have. And if we can all work together on that one thing, you know, here in Arizona, we have campaign finance reform, but nobody uses it.
Yeah.
You know
well,
I mean?
Actually, it got struck down by the Supreme Court. You know,
yours
in Arizona.
What I'm saying is a good thing we can do is the local Occupy groups can our demand can be, hey,
yeah.
let's reform the politics.
Let me even put it in a larger frame, Rob. I I'm an absolute advocate of grassroots movements and then the outside game, and also infiltrating politics and political movements, the inside game. But this has gotten much larger than that. We have reached the cancer stage of capitalism. Capitalism, if it is tightly constrained, as Adam Smith suggested in Wealth of Nations, if it is heavily regulated, if capitalists are allowed, if as it was in the 1700s and the 1800s in the United States, that the first sentence of a corporation's articles of incorporation had to say the first purpose of this corporation is to serve the members of the community or of the state in which this corporation is incorporated. The second purpose is to manufacture railroad cars or whatever it may be. If we were to, you know, once again have a functional regulated capitalist system, then or move even beyond that, frankly, go to things like worker cooperatives, where the workers, and I'm not talking about like your local health food store where the customers own the co-op. I'm talking about a business like Union Cab in Madison, where the workers own the business. If we were to move to that, Mondragon in Spain is the largest in the world. It's an entire chapter in at the end of my book, Threshold. I just lay the whole thing out. Here's how it works. Louise and I went and spent a week there. And it's just amazing to see, laissez-faire capitalism, unregulated capitalism, which was unleashed in the United States in a huge way with the Reagan Revolution, has now reached the cancer stage where it is destroying its host. And that's what we need to fix, in my opinion, among other things. And, of course, the way you fix that is by changing the rules of the game, which is, legislatively. But the legislation doesn't happen until the people stand up and say, damn it, we want it now. Mark in Albuquerque. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to AM 1350. What's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, I just wanted to offer up a few suggestions. My wife and I went down to Occupy Albuquerque this weekend, and my wife's a little prissy, and she was looking around and saying, well, it's kind of dirty down here and all this stuff. And I said, well, honey, that's the way these things are, it's grassroots. And just what I wanted to say was I'm a small business owner, don't really have time to spend down there during the week. But there was about 30 trash bags piled up, and they're keeping it clean as they can, but mm-hmm. I'm going to take my crew down this afternoon when we're done and go get rid of that stuff, haul it off to the dump.
Good on you, Mark.
Also, they're concerned about when the weather gets colder, mm-hmm. what they're going to do. And I have some commercial heaters and generators, and might offer to do something like that for them if we can set up some kind of structure where they could stay warm. So.
That's marvelous.
Just a suggestion to people that are working and really don't have time to get down there and participate as much as they'd like to. There's other things that that we can do to support the cause. You know?
So well said, Mark. And there's so many of us who are needed. I need not add a word to it. You said it brilliantly. Mark, thank you very much. And good on you for what you're doing. From Mark to Mark, this is Mark listening on WDTW in Birmingham, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, lots of Marks today.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this anger at Wall Street, while warranted, misses the fundamental point, which is companies like these big banks, like General Motors, like Freddie and Fannie Mac, are arms of the government. The government is so intertwined with bailing them out and with regulating them that has nothing to do with capitalism. Any free market purist will tell you that that is the antithesis of capitalism, and there is no distinction in these anarchist rallies occupying Wall Street. And I think that, yesterday you're comparing Ayn Rand to a sociopath.
She was a sociopath.
Can I read you three lines of what she actually wrote in her journals, which was a notation for future characters based on not what Hickman did, which she stated, but the outrage at his statements. She she didn't endorse his degeneracy. She definitely condemned it. But her, when he stated, a lot of these serial killers claim and pedophiles claim that they're free of social and moral ethical constraints, and and she was outraged, or people were more outraged at his statements than his crimes. And she,
yeah, people were outraged at his crimes as well, Mark. I would encourage you. Have you ever seen the interview that Mike Wallace did with her on 60 Minutes?
Yeah, I have it on tape.
Yeah,
I have all
okay.
Those on tape.
So you know that you know that Ayn Rand is just as much of a sociopath as Hickman. She just wasn't a serial killer. She
why didn't you?
An economic sociopath.
When you have an Ayn Rand Institute representative, why don't you ever bring these up? And you got this from a Christian. You brought this, got this from a Christian website, which has an axe to grind with atheism. I don't know that doesn't seem to me.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mark.
From First Thoughts, that's where this came up recently. On Joe Carter wrote a piece on First Thoughts.
You know,
Christian blog.
I've been talking about Hickman and Ayn Rand for 8 years on this radio show. This is no secret. This is stuff that back when in 1956, when Alan Greenspan was initiated into Ayn Rand's cult in New York City, and she was having her sex parties and her multiple husbands and all this weird stuff that was going on, because it was like, this is the libertarian paradise, right? We're going to rewrite the rules. We're going to do it all from scratch. We have no obligation to moral society. There is no such thing as society. It's all made up of individuals. Blah, 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 quack, quack, quack. At that time, there was a debate about Hickman and Hickman's influence on Ayn Rand and whether or not the movement itself was essentially sociopathic.
But her point,
I mean, read, if you really consider yourself an objectivist, read the genuine history of it, not the sanitized versions that you'll find that have been rewritten by the Ayn Rand groups.
Can I say one last thing?
Yeah.
If you were honest about her journal, which was a small, she never wrote an article about it, or none of her characters.
No, this was in her diaries.
Right. It was in a journal. It probably wasn't meant to be seen by anyone. And her whole point was that a future character who is convicted of a crime, of a different type of crime, without his degeneracy, meaning Rourke, when he blows up his own buildings because he doesn't want them to be used by collectivists, and then his statements about why he did it, which was because he's an independent, rational, self-sufficient being.
Don't you find it a little weird, Mark, that her characters typically inherited all the money that they had?
You're not going to leave any money to your children? I feel sorry for them.
That's not the point. I just find this theory that, you know, Claudius, I can stand alone, except that I got to have daddy's money in order to be there. There's something. Call back if you can name one country that has ever successfully functioned as a libertarian society.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because there are none, and there never will be any. It's a dysfunctional theology, and it's a theology, not an ideology.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out.
Eventually, I think we will. And part of that working it out is, you know, working together and standing up for the people who are on our side, as it were. And that's the majority of Americans, including working Americans. Julian Tisch is with us. He's an art handler with the Teamsters, Local 814, here in Manhattan. Do I have that right, Julian?
Yeah, right. Upper East Side of New York.
Great. And Teamster.org is the website. And tell me about, the action that you guys are involved with the Gilded Halls of Sotheby's, and, B, how the Occupy Wall Street movement is interacting with you.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Tom. So the situation myself and the 42 of my coworkers find ourselves in is that we've been locked out by Sotheby's, which is the famous auction house company, where we unload the trucks and set up the exhibitions and handle the priceless works of art there. So we've been locked out of our job for almost 3 months now because we're refusing a long laundry list of concessions, which would turn a very good working class job into a really typical throwaway Walmart type job. And so because my coworkers had the decency to stand up and say, this is not the kind of country we want, and it's not the kind of shop that we want, we've been put out on the street where we've been walking a picket line and organizing other actions for the last 3 months.
So you guys are the guys who handled the million and multi-million dollar pieces of art, bringing them into Sotheby's and then carrying them out when some other billionaire bought them, and which seems to me like not just – this isn't just like moving furniture. There's got to be a skill set associated with that. And a substantial one. And Sotheby's is saying, or Sotheby's, however you say it, is saying, nah, we don't want to pay you so much anymore. And so you guys are engaged in a union action.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, like I said, we've been locked out. We've been fighting for our jobs. But what we're really fighting for, Tom, is the next generation of workers who are going to be at the shop at Sotheby's.
Right.
Because Sotheby's is currently demanding that all new hires would not have the democratic, you know, protections of the union, would not have health benefits, and would not have any job security or any retirement. Basically, they wouldn't have any future. So, I mean, they're asking me.
They've been listening to the libertarians.
I don't know about that, but they're asking me to take a take up. But what's more offensive in a year where they made $680 million is that they're asking to really, you know, destroy this job that supports working families in New York.
Yeah. And have you guys had any interactions with the Occupy Wall Street movements or any you know, are people dropping by or, you know,
sure.
It's kind of in the air, I suppose. No,
it's definitely in the air in New York and all throughout the rest of the country. And we're sort of, you know, honored and flattered to have a lot of support from a lot of different young activists, young and old activists who are starting to participate in the Occupy Wall Street movement. We've had folks walking our picket line with us. We've had some of our members spreading the word down at Ducati Park. And we've generally received a lot of support from this new layer of activists that everyone's talking about now.
That is great. That is great. Julian Tisch, an art handler with the Teamsters Local 814 here in New York, teamster.org, of course, the website for the Teamsters. Anything else people need to know about how to find out more about what you're doing, or is that pretty much it?
Well, I'll just give one more plug, Tom. Thanks for having me again. But folks can log on to www.sotheby'sbadforart.com and can hear a little more backstory on our situation and follow any updates and figure out where we're going to be next if you want to lend a hand for this really important fight.
Okay, you got it. Julian, thanks so much for being on the program with us.
Thank you. Take care.
Good talking with you and good luck in keeping going on this thing. Amazing. David in New York City. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, yeah, Tom. Yeah, I was at the rally on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of confusing because I was right there on 46th Street, kind of penned in. I was standing next to tourists. There was older people. It was a really nice mix of crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one point, everybody said, sit down. So I figured, okay, here's civil disobedience time. I thought, this ought to be interesting. We're going to have like 10,000 people sitting down. It'll be funny to see how the cops are going to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting prepared to get whisked away, and I thought this was going to be a great thing, you know. And then can you imagine 10,000 people demanding jury trials, you know?
Yeah.
And I was sitting next to an Italian tourist. He was just decided, I want to join this too.
Uh-huh.
So, to make a long story short, next thing I know, some of the people that were with Occupy Wall Street said, okay, everybody, we're getting up. We got other places to go. And as I tried to go, I thought, well, maybe, you know, there's another plan.
Right.
Everybody got dispersed. So, I'm just saying, I really think the civil disobedience thing is the way to go. I really do.
Yeah. Well, historically, it's worked very, very well. And, David, your point is well taken. I, you know, none of us can speak for anybody other than ourselves, but excellent point. Thank you. Julie in Los Angeles. Let's see on KTLK. Hey, Julie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I adore you. You're so smart. I want to ask you for help with this theory that Republicans seem to have that if you tax the wealthiest people in the country, that they'll provide jobs for people. And I just need you to explain to me in layman's terms why that's not correct.
Okay, it's really simple. What you found in the period from the 1930s, I think it was 31 when Herbert Hoover raised the top income tax rate to 91%. What you found from then until 19, what was it, 86, I think, when Reagan, when it was at 74%, and he dropped it down to 28%. What you found during that period of time was that the average CEO only made 30 times what the average bottom-paid worker made. And the reason why was because after 30 times what the average person is making, which is a pretty damn good living, by the way, I mean, that would be, you know, a million bucks a year or so in today's dollars. After that, it was like, hey, well, you know, why give it all to the government? And so what CEOs did is they left it in their business, which meant that they would invest it in advertising. They would grow the business. They'd build another factory. They would, you know, they would develop marketing for their products. Whereas once Reagan crashed that top tax rate for the very wealthy, they just started sucking the money out of their businesses and playing casino with it. You know, it was hot money on Wall Street, which is what brought about the crash and not only didn't create any jobs, but destroyed millions of jobs. Make sense?
Yes, it's frustrating. I don't. If I had a nickel for every time a Republican said that, I'd be rich.
Yeah, well, you know, they keep calling these rich people job creators. They're not. The job creators are the consumers and the workers. Julie, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Some interesting reports we had in the last hour from various Occupy movements around the country. And we will be getting back into a conversation of that. Breaking news, by the way. I'm broadcasting today live from New York City and on Wall Street. Just down the road, Goldman Sachs, they're not doing so well this quarter. So they just announced for the next 9 months, they're going to lower their median employee compensation. This is for the 34,200 workers at Goldman Sachs, so that the median income, median and average are different for, you know, if you're a statistician wonk, but anyhow, the median income is now only going to be $292,836 per employee. Tough news for Goldman Sachs. But maybe there's some good news on the horizon. Phil Kirpin, the vice president for policy at Americans for Prosperity, has a new book out called Democracy Denied, How Obama is Ignoring You and Bypassing Congress to Radically Transform America and How to Stop Him. His website, philkirpin.com. Phil, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
So, Phil, this sounds really exciting to me. I mean, I'm reading through the press release and the summary on your book, and it sounds to me like President Obama is doing the stuff that we progressives have been asking him to do for a long, long time. I mean, you know, tell me this is true that he's been. Oh, geez, somehow I lost all my highlights. Just got vanished. My page got. But in any case, for example, you say that global warming. He's using the EPA to promote cap and trade. I had no idea.
Yeah, actually, the same abatement schedule from the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill was written into the EPA's budget request by President Obama, and he's having them pursue it by a variety of regulations, not the least of which is PSD and Title V permitting, which the EPA in a recent court filing said would require 230,000 additional EPA bureaucrats to take down to the statutory threshold because the law was never written for that purpose. So that's one example. But Tom,
this is marvelous. So he's actually using executive power to do something about global warming?
The law and the Constitution and someone, you know, I know that from your work you have great respect for our democratic institutions. Certainly you've got to be concerned that these powers are being used to sidestep Congress, even if you agree with the particular policy purposes for which they're being used.
Well, one of the unique things about this, Phil,
for 4 years, and I hope that you recognize that if we don't have effective checks and balances, these expansive executive powers will be used in a lot of ways that you won't like as well.
Phil, let's not filibuster each other, okay?
Sorry.
Yeah, you know, as you well know, if the president goes nuts, Congress can stop him. I mean, there are checks and balances there. If the president issues an executive order that the Congress doesn't like, they can pass a piece of legislation nullifying it. And then he'd have to get a two-thirds majority. You know, he'd have to override a veto. He'd have to veto it. Then you know they could over. I mean, there is a check and balance system there. So apparently if he's doing this stuff, he's doing it with the permission of Congress, And I think that's marvelous. When does cap and trade go into effect?
Well, you know, they've talked about potentially doing an actual emissions trading scheme as part of a new source performance standard for power
plants.
So
he's just talking about it?
They've delayed those regulations until next year. I think the Title V and PFD permitting is already in effect for large sources, and they're going to ratchet it down over time to smaller sources. And that, I think, is where there are major cost drivers.
So right now, the big operations like the Koch brothers, paper factories and their refineries, they're having to trade emissions permits in the open market already?
Well, they don't have emissions trading. I think that if they do that, it'll be part of the NSPS that may come out next year. But they do have to file for permitting for greenhouse gases, which is new under this administration.
That's marvelous. I'm so glad to hear that. The Obama health law in your book, Democracy Denied, you say that Obama's regulators have hijacked the Obama health law to make it worse.
Well, I think it's important to remember the extremely perverse process that was used to pass that. And when Scott Brown was elected by the people of Massachusetts specifically to be the deciding vote to stop that law, that day Barney Frank said that it would be wrong to ignore those voters and to contrive to pass it anyway. And then Ron Pollack of the pharmaceutical industry-funded Union Front Group, came up with the idea of going around Congress, going around the process in the Massachusetts election by enacting a discussion draft that the Senate had passed in order to go into conference and putting a discussion draft into the U.S. Code. And so we've got this contradictory mess of a discussion draft that has all sorts of flaws in it.
Phil, it sounds
to me
like...
And the regulators are driving trucks through it. They're exercising vast discretion to figure it all out.
It sounds to me like you're making sweeping arguments that horrible things are happening or massive things are happening, and in fact it's like stuff is being fixed or fiddled with around the edges, whatnot, which I think one would expect. But here's my question, which is really simple. With the health insurance companies under Obamacare, they are now required to at least spend $700 out of every $1,000 that they collect from you and me in payments on actually paying for health care. Before that, in some cases, they were taking 40-50% of that money, and Stephen Jay Hemsley and Bill McGuire, the CEO and former CEO of United Healthcare, making over $1 billion. I mean, as a CEO, tell me that. So how possibly could a government administrative agency that operates with an overhead of 3-5% do a worse job of ripping us off than our for-profit healthcare system that has given us the world's most expensive healthcare system and with some of the worst outcomes on the planet?
Well,
we
haven't had a free market healthcare system in this country since the perverse IRS regulations that led to the third party payment system, which you would never get in a free market. So I agree with you. There are big problems in healthcare even before this.
There's no such thing as a free market, Phil. Come on.
Well, I would disagree with that.
You think there are free baseball games?
I don't even understand what you mean by
that. Where each team gets to decide how many balls or strikes they're going to have?
Of course, there has to be a referee. I would agree with that.
There have to be rules. So if there's rules, who makes the rules?
The problem.
No, who makes the rules, Phil?
Well, I would hope that we make them in a democratic fashion.
Okay, so the government makes the rules of an economy, right?
This is, I think, the critical distinction. And
that's why there's no such thing as a free economy.
Well, this is the critical distinction. I think those rules need to be made by our duly elected representatives who we can hold accountable at the ballot box, not by unelected bureaucrats and regulators, but Congress.
How about
unelected lobbyists?
How about not by unelected lobbyists? Will you join me in calling for, stripping the cash out of politics?
Well, I think that the right to petition government is a pretty fundamental right, so I'd be very careful to restrict lobbying for that reason. But I do think that, we've got to have decisions being made in a fashion that's transparent. The healthcare law rewarded converted many of those moneyed interests. And I know you oppose the individual mandate without a public option because it's a pure giveaway of hundreds of billions of dollars to these healthcare companies. The hospitals cut a deal. The pharmaceutical companies cut a deal. This was not a bill that really anyone could be happy with. And I think that...
I'm very happy with it. The net of it was that while it was a far from perfect bill, and particularly once when the waivers kick in so that Vermont can have its own single-payer system, Montana can have its own...
to these companies?
I beg your pardon?
You want to give $200 billion directly to these health insurance companies that you've been so critical of, taxpayer dollars and subsidies?
If that's what it takes over the short term to make sure that we don't have 40,000 people a year dying in the United States because our system is so dysfunctional that we've got 50 million people who are uninsured, sure.
Well, I think the problem of the uninsured could have been dealt with in a much more targeted fashion. That
I agree. Medicare for everybody. Medicare Part E. Get these corporations. We're the only country in the developed world that doesn't make it criminal to do what the health insurance companies do in the United States.
Tom, can we agree in the civil liberties area that there have been abuses of executive power in both the Bush and Obama administration?
Yes, we can absolutely agree on that. Phil Kirpin, philkirpin.com. Thanks, Phil.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Phil's new book, Democracy Denied, just FYI. We'll be right back. Percenter song? I don't know. Whatever it is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting today from New York City at the world headquarters of Dial Global, one of our syndicators, one of our favorites. Ron in Minot, North Dakota. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hey, thanks, Tom. Well, I just heard your debate with Phil Kelpern, and that health insurance one. It seems to me there are lots of things like the military or the highway system or public education that are services that provide for the public. I mean, if the fire protection is left to the fire on your house gets put out if you can pay for it, well, a whole neighborhood could burn down.
So
I think Medicare is the same way.
Yeah.
Medical care, that I think it's a public good for us. Diseases can spread to other people. And
that's how we got public fire departments. We used to have private fire departments in the United States, in many parts of the United States. And if you paid the local fire department, you had their shield in front of your house, and then some of them competed with each other and whatnot. And you paid them, there was a fire, they'd drive by. If you had the shield, they'd put the fire out. If they didn't, they'd keep on driving by.
Yeah.
And I think it was probably largely after the Great Chicago Fire, but I don't really know the timeline of history. I've read that in a number of different places, but never seen it really authoritatively, that basically all of America woke up, or the vast majority. There's still a few small towns with privatized fire departments in this country, but basically everybody woke up and said, this is nuts. You correctly point out, if one person's house is on fire and nobody puts it out, it could very easily jump to the next person. And it's the same thing with healthcare. If one person has a contagious disease, you want that cured.
Yes. Now, here in North Dakota, I'm a public employee. I get Blue Shield Blue Cross. I'm amazed at the overcharges and the forced. I went in for a growth that was removed. It was non-cancerous. I had to have four biopsies on it. Unnecessary. At points, I rebelled, and they says, we cannot go on with our procedure. For a small growth under my eye here, small growth, I could have, not even bigger than that, excuse my language, a booger, not any bigger than that, $3,000. I know the insurance companies milk them, and Blue Shield Blue Cross, if you look this up, they actually use their, insurance company as profit-making industry. They use their profits to throw a party in Jamaica for Blue Shield Blue Cross workers of North Dakota employees.
Amazing.
So, they misspend this money. They overcharge. It needs to be regulated. I used to live in Montana, and I was sorry that Max Baucus sold out when he said that he would not put the single-payer healthcare person on the table.
Right.
You know, he wanted to preserve that.
When the physicians for national health care and the nurses showed up and wanted to speak, he had them arrested and hauled off. Ron, you make an excellent point, and I thank you very much for calling and sharing with us. We've got a lot of callers. I want to get as many as we can in here. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's up?
Hey, I'm talking about how McCain today was saying that.
You mean Herman Cain?
Obama's just out there campaigning, and he's really not. He's just telling the American people about his jobs bill.
Oh, you mean the Republicans are criticizing the president for traveling around the United States trying to stir up grassroots support for his jobs bill, and they're saying that this is a secret presidential campaign.
And said something about that his bus is made in Canada. Well, it's not him that made the decision. That was the Secret Service.
Well, and not only that, it wasn't him who established the trade policies that we have right now. It began with Ronald Reagan. It went through the George Herbert Walker administration. Actually, really began with Richard Nixon, you know, trying to open us up to China, and then you know Bill Clinton, and so it's and then George W. Bush. I mean, and in fact, on George W. Bush, it really went on steroids. It's the last 10 years we've lost over 50,000 factories. That's when it got really, really bad. So Go ahead.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
When was Wall Street deregulated? When did that all happen?
There were two major steps, and I encourage you to write down and Google Bill Seidman, S-E-I-D-M-A-N. Maybe it's I-E, but I think it's S-E-I-D-M-A-N. And there's an 8-part YouTube, 10-minute YouTube pieces of a speech that he gave in Grand Rapids about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. He died last year. And he was the guy that Reagan put in charge of the Resolution Trust Corporation when the S&Ls went down in the 80s. And he's a brilliant economist. He's the guy that oversaw prosecuting 1,000 banksters or 1,600 banksters, putting 1,000 of them in jail. He's the one who oversaw destroying all the equity of the stockholders in these S&Ls. But making sure that the depositors were protected. He's the one who basically federalized the S&Ls in over a 20-year period, actually showed a profit for the federal government as they eventually sold them back into the private marketplace. And he identifies Alan Greenspan, and he was a close personal friend of Greenspan's. And he talks in this series about how, and in fact, we've got some of the clips from it. I've played them on this show before. I'm not going to dig them out now because we've got so many other things going on. But he talks about how Greenspan thought that if you just let the bankers do what they wanted to do, that everything would be great. And that was all you had to do. And he talks about how back in the 80s and 90s, particularly in the 90s, that Greenspan let the banks basically go from the asset to lending ratio, to betting ratio of 10 to 1 or 11 to 1, up to 36 to 1. And that was the beginning. And then, of course, you had these two pieces of legislation, Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, both authored by Phil Gramm, that in 1999 and 2000, or 2000 and 2001, that really blew the door out. So that's basically it happened in the late 90s and into 2000.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your thoughts on the Obama health law, on the Occupy movements. Is a bailout a loan or a giveaway? The economy shouldn't dictate policy. What? Tom Hartman here broadcasting from Manhattan, from New York Island. From Manhattan Island, New York City. And I got to tell you a really just short little story, and then I want to get to your calls because there's some great topics that I so want to riff off of that I know some of you want to talk about here. This morning, I had an opportunity to have just a one-on-one conversation, Louise and I, and the CEO of a major corporation, a New York Stock Exchange listed corporation. A member of the 1% who's on our side. And he said, You know what these guys on, I'm paraphrasing now because I obviously I can't quote him verbatim, and I'm not going to out who he is, but he said words to the effect of, you know what these guys on Wall Street did over the last couple of decades? He said they broke the trust, the sacred trust, the covenant, the sacred trust that they had with the American people. They broke that sacred trust and made off with trillions of dollars. And then when they got busted, when they fell down, we bailed them out, and now they're breaking it again. And that's why people are so angry. And that's why it's not just the people on the, you know, it's not just kids with student loans, and it's not just people who've lost their jobs who are angry. He said, I'm angry. And this is a guy who's making big bucks and who's running up, like I said, a New York Stock Exchange listed company. I mean, it's incredible. It's just incredible. People get it. We've been robbed. We've been robbed by the banksters, and it was done perfectly legally because the Supreme Court has said money is speech and corporations are people, and therefore it's okay to buy politicians or to destroy politicians. And that's about as bad as it gets. Keith in Farmersville, Kentucky. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Howdy. I was listening to a piece on NPR probably a few weeks ago, and the way they explained a bailout, especially for the automotive industry, was that they were loans from the federal government to these automobile companies, you know, with interest, so that the automobile companies actually ended up paying back the government with interest.
So right. So far, we have made money on the GM deal. We haven't made money on the Chrysler deal yet, and may or may not, but we've made money on the GM deal.
So I guess my question is, are the bailouts for Wall Street the same as automobile company bailouts? Is a bailout a bailout? I mean,
no.
It's a loan, correct?
No. Yeah, here's the difference. The bailouts that were passed by Congress were basically, you know, here's a loan, you know, pay the money back with interest. And in the case, for example, of General Motors, you know, it was not basically free money. And it kept people going. And that was the deal that actually General Motors was the deal that President Obama put together. What the Bush administration had done and what the Fed had done, more importantly, both during the Bush administration and possibly in the early years of the Obama administration, we don't know, because Bernie Sanders, you know, he got that audit of the Fed through the first time since it was created in 1913, but it was a one-year audit. And it was looking at that year of 2008-2009 of, you know, what happened, or 2007, that period, that window of time when it crashed, which was basically, you know, the last year of the Bush administration.
Right.
And what we know is that not only did the banksters get $700-800 billion from that, you know, when Hank Paulson came out and said, give me the, you know, here's a three-page demand, Congress, I want $800 billion to give to the banks. But the banksters also got somewhere between $12 and $16 trillion at virtually no interest. And much of what the banksters did with that money was they then bought treasuries. In other words, they would park it at the Fed. And so they're borrowing money from the Fed at 0.1%. They give it to the Fed, you know, they buy treasuries that pay 2 or 3% interest. And so, and when you're talking about $1 trillion, you know, 2 or 3%, you're talking billions of dollars, right?
Yeah, right.
And they're just making money sitting on the money. And people wonder, you know, what's going on? Why isn't, you know, why? And, well, that's what's going on. It's like the game is rigged. The game has been rigged, and we need to unrig the game. And that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, Ron Paul, I mean, he gets a couple things right. His libertarian stuff and his Tenter stuff and his, you know, free market stuff is unsupportable, frankly. But I'm with him on things like, you know, let's decriminalize pot and prostitution. And, you know, I mean, that's why I say libertarians are Republicans who want to, you know, smoke dope and get laid. But he also has been on the Fed forever. And I'm with him on this. The Fed, at the very least, needs to be made 100% transparent. And at the very best, needs to be nationalized, brought under the Treasury Department with some kind of firewall so it can't be manipulated politically from administration to administration. And the way that they do that now is that the president appoints the chairman for, I believe it's a 10-year term. So, you know, it's you're going to inherit one and you're going to pass along one, but it's not going to be so political. And but it's not a lifetime term, so it's not as bad as the Supreme Court. But, you know, right. Yeah, but that's what's going cool. on. And no, a bailout's not a bailout. And when it comes to the banksters, for the small businesses. And then, you know, 2 weeks ago, you had Bernie Sanders questioning Ben Bernanke. And he says, in this audit, we discovered that you were giving not only to the banks, but to Toyota or Honda or something, to one of the Japanese car companies. Gave free money. And he said, you know, you were giving it to these multi-trillion dollar transnational corporations and to American, quote, corporations like General Electric that do more than half of their business overseas and make more than half of their profits outside the United States. Did you give any to small businesses in America? Small businesses with fewer than 500 employees?
Yeah.
And Bernanke's answer was, no, that's not our job. And at that point, you just go, okay, this is just a totally corrupt institution. Keith, thanks for the call. I do have to move along. I get some more calls in here. Rick in Pasadena. Hey, Rick, what's up?
How you doing, sir?
I am well.
I wanted to talk to you about something because you were asking about next steps for Occupy Wall Street. And I wanted to talk about something that happened in 2004 with a company called Sinclair Broadcasting.
Yeah.
They wanted to show, you know, the story. They wanted to show this corrupted John Kerry pseudo documentary.
Right.
And a lot of people were up in arms about it. And what happened was there was a group of individuals that started looking into, since it's a publicly owned company, into their 401k plans and looking in at the mutual funds that Sinclair was part of the investment in. And eventually what happened was we started putting pressure on investment firms that had Sinclair as part of their portfolio. The stock price of Sinclair dropped about $105 million in a week, about 17% of its stock.
Yikes.
And I really think that is something that, you know, this was a small group of people at a short time. The ability to...
You're talking about what's called shareholder activism. And the upside of it is that you can get somebody's attention really fast. And there are a number of groups around the country that do this. In particular, there's a couple of groups of nuns, you know, of Catholic nuns who have been buying enough stock that they can show up at shareholder meetings and you know, raise enough ruckus, get things on the ballots and things. But the downside of shareholder activism is that typically it's not long-lasting. And you know, to have really long-lasting effect, what we need to do is change the rules of the game. You know, the strike zone in baseball has been modified over and over and over again since Babe Ruth's days to compensate for the changing physiology of people. I'd say steroids, but whatever. You know, it got bigger, it got smaller, it got bigger. They raised the mound, they lowered the mound. But you know, basically the goal every time they changed it, you know, every time baseball changed the rules, was to make the game more fair.
Right.
And that's an important thing in sports. It's why the NFL is like the most socialist of all organizations. Whatever team is, you know, wins the season gets the crappiest pick next time around, and whatever team loses the season gets the very best pick in next time around, you know, when new blood is being brought in, you know, when new people are being recruited. And again, to bring about fairness. So if we understand that in our sports games we need fairness, why don't we understand that in our economy we need fairness? Because it's just another game. It's just that you play the game instead of trying to, you know, get the ball, you know, beyond the outfield or get the ball over the goalposts. You know, the game is made to make a little money. I mean, why not?
I think, though, that there is a really good opportunity to focus on companies that are, have predatory practices of predatory capitalism in the United States, especially if they're publicly owned.
But let's, instead of outing them with the goal of crashing their stock price for 3 weeks and, you know, whatever, let's out them with the goal of shaming legislators into changing the laws. Let's change the strike zone.
I agree with you totally. I'm I'm thinking of this as an option until we get responsible candidates,
yeah.
Which, you know as well as I do, that's going to be a lot quicker, a lot farther along.
Well, I'm actually very optimistic. I think this election of 2012 is going to be a change election, and I think we're going to see a whole heck of a lot more change than people expect. But I'm with you, Rick. I'm not an opponent of shareholder activism. I just think we also need to look at the bigger picture.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More ear calls, and we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. today and around the world. Tom Hartman here with you from New York City, where, by the way, just a heads up, 4 o'clock this afternoon, I'll be on Dylan, sometime after 4. That's when the show starts, I'm pretty sure. It's 4 o'clock, isn't it? Yeah, 4 o'clock. On Dylan Radigan's program, talking about corporate personhood and money in politics. So that should be very entertaining. And we will be getting to your calls and to a whole variety of topics here, from raising taxes, Occupy Santa Fe, economic crisis and failed privatization, free trade, fighting against Grover Norquist, the Electoral College, Occupy San Francisco, the religious GOP. But right now, Ellen Ratner is with us in our studio in Washington, D.C., and to tell us, and by the way, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, greetings.
Greetings. Well, I'll tell you, Tom, I'm in your chair, but I definitely can't feel your shoes. What's interesting is when you talk tonight on the Dylan Radigan program, I will have to make sure that you are in on that Supreme Court argument when it happens on the issue of Shell, and can a corporation, do they have the same responsibility as people?
Yeah, that would be a very interesting
thing. Okay, so the president today gave his jobs speech again in North Carolina. He said his jobs bill would curb some of the trends in terms of teacher losing their jobs and schools having to cut back on vital programs which are helping young people, and also the resources that we need to put in as a country in education. Of course, he is going to try and get $30 billion just for teachers if he does nothing else. Okay, FreedomWorks.
We had the vice president of FreedomWorks on our program.
Oh, really?
For 15
well, you know,
today.
I took a look at who's on their board today. Dick Armey, Richard Stevenson from Cancer.
Dick Armey's the CEO, isn't he?
He's the
chairman.
Yeah, okay. Cancer Treatments of America. Steve Forbes on their board, and Boyden Gray. Used to be the Bush White House counsel.
Yeah.
Lives in Georgetown.
Very interesting.
Anyway, they are now saying that they want to eliminate the Department of Education. They had a little tiff this morning thing. They want to eliminate HUD. They want to privatize Fannie and Freddie. And they want to eliminate $6 trillion from the budget over 10 years. Meanwhile, Secretary Clinton did a surprise visit to Libya today. $11 million is what they're giving just for medical supplies. There's 15,000 wounded after the fighting, 1,500 amputees. They don't really have the equipment for that. Some people, I guess, they're going to try and send out. They're going to fly in some others. They also have a program to destroy shoulder-to-air missiles that I guess Gaddafi was collecting on.
To take out American planes.
The AP did a little addition, and what they found out is that there was about $135 million so far in aid. The president is going to.
May I ask you a very quick question about that, Ellen, before you move on?
Sure.
This was the. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. My understanding is that this was basically the last city in Libya to fall. This was the hometown and stronghold of Gaddafi. Is that all true?
As far as I know, okay. And that they also caught one of the sons as he was trying to escape.
Right. Well, that was my last question. There's been a lot of speculation that the reason the fighting has been so fierce in this town is that Gaddafi's hanging out, downtown someplace. Are they going to, I'm assuming that they're going to go house to house. Is he there? Has he slipped out of the country?
We don't have any intelligence on that, but obviously they must feel that they have full control if Hillary Clinton and somebody from the European Union was there on Monday. So
yeah.
I think they feel like, you know, things
very
are pretty safe.
So it's just a while until the spider hole is found.
Right, exactly. President Barack Obama is going to sign the free trade agreements with South Korea, Panama, and Colombia on Friday. In addition to those three free trade agreements, the president's going to renew the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program that provides American workers at risk about $575 million in benefits for the year, fiscal years 2012 and 2013. That's retraining. He's going to sign it and then deliver remarks from the Rose Garden.
So basically, we sign the free trade deals that send our jobs overseas, and then we appropriate money to retrain those people who just lost their jobs to do what?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there certainly aren't the manufacturing jobs and the kind of jobs that they lost, and you and I know that.
Yeah.
It looks like the Pentagon is still trying to figure out a way to keep more forces in Iraq other than the 160 or whatever that are going to be assigned to the embassy. The sticking point is apparently that the Iraqis want the forces there and future forces to be part and under Iraqi law. The U.S. government doesn't want to. We still have 39,000 troops. We have shipped out 1.6 million pieces of equipment. We have 800,000 pieces of equipment left to get out of there before it turns into a pumpkin on January 1st.
Wow. Or that we just simply leave behind and say, here's a gift to you.
Right. Exactly. Make it into scrap metal or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
There is a Nevada debate tonight minus Johns Huntsman. He said he did not want to upset New Hampshire by going to the debate. And a date has been set for the Iowa primaries on the 3rd. We still don't know from New Hampshire. We'll see what happens on that front.
I've heard that Huntsman may be on the edge of dropping out because
he's got no money and he's in debt, but his father has a lot of money.
Oh, that's true.
So we'll see. And his father wants him to be president. And I, you know, my guess is he may stick around through the New Hampshire primary. Why not?
And he's been enough of a nice guy that maybe he's running for vice president. Although I can't see two Mormons on a ticket. It's just, you know, the Christian conservatives would just.
I was hoping you'd be in there, but I'm going to hold this up to the camera, Tom.
Okay.
This is the big announcement. Drum roll. The Republicans now have their logo for the Republican convention. I thought you'd be really excited about that.
And please describe it to me, because I can't see
it. Oh, okay. It has an American flag with an elephant on it, and it said Republican National Convention, Tampa Bay.
Does the elephant have upside-down stars on it?
No, the elephant has no stars, but it's got a big trunk.
I see. Okay, so they took off the upside-down stars, at least. At least they have some grace.
Yeah. I thought you'd be like jumping for joy, Tom.
I look forward to seeing it tomorrow when I get back, Ellen. Ellen Ryder with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from New York City. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. How you doing, my brother?
Hey, brother. I got to have an operation for cancer.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Sam.
Well, the doctor said they caught it early, so one doctor says something positive, and another one says more serious. So I just directed all to Jesus, the great physician.
There you go. Sam, I'll keep you in my prayers. And for those who don't do prayers, keep Sam in your good thoughts and send him some light. And anything political on your mind?
And that's what I love about your program, because you all seek the truth.
Well, thank you.
And let the floodgates of journalism flow,
okay.
And not the one gate of Fox News. And, you know, I felt like a spirit coming over our country back there when G.W. Bush started talking about Gaddafi, getting him amnesty, and he walked through Wall Street. And, you know, that said, just no regulation, just go for whatever. And I think it was his experiment on American democracy or something he was trying to prove. Mm-hmm. And my daughter wrote an article in the newspaper at Nelsonville Community College, mm-hmm. Hawking Tech Community College, and they published a story. And you know what? They did away with the newspaper the next semester.
Oh, my.
So
oh my.
That was in 05.
Yeah. Well, Sam.
About credit cards and student loans.
Yeah. Activism has its consequences. And good on your daughter. Sam, you are, as I said, you're in my prayers. Thank you for calling and sharing with
us. Thank you for being here and letting me unleash some of this.
It's always a pleasure,
thank
Sam.
You let me ranting.
Yeah, there you go. It's always a pleasure. Do good.
And we got to remember what Mark Twain said, right?
What's that?
You know, his philosophy.
I don't. Refresh my memory. Oh, Sam is gone. Okay, we'll have to get Mark Twain's philosophy from Sam some other time. Jason in Chicago. Hey, Jason, what's up? Jason? No, Jason. Okay, Sean in Battleground, Washington. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, a quick word on Libya. I think people like George Clooney are, you know, don't understand the history of Africa. They're really putting their faith in the corporate Democrats. They have nothing good in store for any part of Africa. They're going to put in a Saudi-style puppet monarchy that's going to open up the country to the multinational oil companies, and it's just a complete tragedy and a disaster. But that's not the reason I called.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Okay. The reason I called, Tom, was, you know, here we are in the second Great Depression, and one of the most disgusting things about watching the Republican debates is they continuously bring up this idea of the Community Reinvestment Act, when it's been proven over and over again that black families were disproportionately steered into these high-risk mortgages when they would have qualified for normal mortgages.
That's right.
And
really, the Community Reinvestment Act was just an anti-redlining law. That's all it was.
Exactly right. Exactly right. But the overall point that I'm calling to make today, Tom, though, is that I think one way of looking at this second Great Depression is as looking at it as a failed privatization scheme. For decades, the way we dealt with the problem of housing for poor and low-income people was through public housing. Mm-hmm. And it was a scheme to privatize housing for poor folks that put us in this mess. Mm-hmm. Wall Street supported the securitization of these mortgages, these high-risk mortgages, and what we really have here is a failed privatization scheme. We need to go back to good, high-quality public housing for low-income people.
Yeah, it's a good excellent suggestion. And by the way, we've got a lot of empty housing stock right now. So
that's right.
We've got a lot of raw material to work with.
As Richard Wolff always says, too, you know, we can't – re-regulation is not the solution. You know, it'd be great to bring back Glass-Steagall, but we can't leave the same people in power with all the same levers to pull to just put us right back in this situation in the future. They have every incentive to undo the regulation. They have all the means to undo the regulation. We have to seize the power from that group. We can't let the capitalists have that much control in our government.
We have to pull the weed out by its root, and the
exactly.
root is the concept that corporations are people and money is speech,
right.
and everything else, you know, it's like, you know, the old biblical notion, you know, the root of all evil is the love of money. In the case of politics, the root of all evil is the notion that corporations are people and money is speech. And
can you imagine fighting a war where you don't totally defeat your enemy, where you leave your enemy with all the weaponry, all the means of rearming himself, of keeping his economy going? No, you have to eliminate. You have to win the war.
I'm reluctant to use military metaphors, but your point is well made, Sean, and thank you very much for calling and making it. Chris in San Luis Obispo says you want to disagree with me. Chris, what's up?
Hello.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine. What'd you call about?
I'd like to start out by saying about probably 9 months ago, I considered myself left of center, and I educate myself and I read, and I think if people all would look into what really runs the country, which is economics, and they get alternate viewpoints from what we've been getting from our state-run schools, they'll find out that economics really runs everything. It always has. And that's why I think people need to realize that Ron Paul is the only candidate that we can have. And
Here's the problem, Chris. If you want our public schools to educate our kids so that they understand that economics is what drives everything, which is by and large true, then Ron Paul's not your guy because he doesn't want there to be any public schools. He wants them to only be private schools, which means only rich people get to go to school, which takes us back, as I said earlier, back before the Civil War. I mean, that's where Ron Paul wants to take America. Kara in San Francisco on listening on Green 960. Hey, Kara, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I want to talk about two things. One is the rally and also where the movement's going to. But I was sick. I couldn't go to the San Francisco rally, and I was just watching it on. Do you know about OccupyStream.com?
I know that there's a bunch of different streams for different occupations around the country. And
right. Yeah, you can go on there and you
there
can
are now competing on ones. Yeah.
Yeah, really, I know. Anyway, I was on OccupyStream.com, and I would go. Mostly I was watching the San Francisco live stream, which is kind of limp at this point because they don't have anybody to constantly man it, so it had a lot of the same stuff going on. And when they would show where it was on the street, it looked really unappetizing. And I, you know, was like, maybe I should go to L.A., you know. But now they've moved to Justin Herman Plaza, which is a lovely, lovely
That's right, down by
park.
The Embarcadero.
Yeah, and it's got palm trees, and we're hanging flags, and there's a lot of good conversation going on that, you know, we're spending our days just discussing things with each other about, you know, what we can do to improve things. I myself make buttons for a living, and I came down here, and I've been giving away buttons for the price of telling me your name, where you're from, and why you're here.
Oh, that's
great.
And it's
been really interesting to see why people are here. And one thing's for certain, everybody's really fed up with the 1% greed ruling everything and it affecting our lives.
Yeah, there you
anyway,
go.
I just wanted to also invite people in the Bay Area. Actually, when I go on the global stream and I say I'm from San Francisco, they're giving me flack. They're saying, hey, what's going on? Why don't you have a rally happening there? You're the bastion of activism. How come nobody's coming out? And my theory is, A, that it looks so crappy at that other location, and B, also, like, you know, we have it kind of nice here. We're sitting in front of our Macintosh computers drinking our Napa wine, smoking
our
humble
tea. Well, it's not just
that.
You actually have in San Francisco instant runoff voting. So you got Green Party candidates and socialist candidates who can run for mayor.
Right.
You know, I mean,
we have it better.
Yeah, you've got one of the most open and diverse political systems in the United States, and it's something that we need to be bringing to every city in the United States. I don't know if this has anything to do with why or what there is or isn't a larger movement there, but it'll grow, Kara. And thanks for sharing your story with us. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Everything You Know Is Wrong, coming up next. Look out.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make
Yeah, let's talk about sex, baby. See, that's the problem. That's the problem. This sexualization of society in general and kids in particular. I think this is fascinating. You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes even everything, as the Fire Sign Theater says, that you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Well, this is, would you let your daughter play lingerie football? Megan Rosker is with us. She is a writer, former public school teacher, promoter of education reform, and the website is letchildrenplay.com. Megan, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you. I understand there is this new lingerie football league.
That's correct. In fact, Tom, it's not new. I think it's been around for about 6 or 7 years, actually. It's just, I think it's gained a lot of steam in the last maybe year. They have their own schedule now.
And
it's getting
quite popular. Televised?
I believe it is, yes. I think it's carried on MTV.
Oh, my. And now, I'm assuming that it sounds to me like this is just kind of the piece that you wrote, the article you wrote, is basically about a father who is, you know, proud of his daughter because she was in this lingerie football league. And you know, women playing football in bras and panties. And how, you know, that's like, you know, no way to parent, and that's, you know, that kind of thing. But it also speaks to this issue of, this is, you know, naked mud wrestling or mud wrestling with women in bikinis used to be something
right.
that was like in bars, you know. And
right,
this is
right.
like taking it out into the public.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I don't want to sound like a total prude here. I think in many ways, you know, I'm pretty anti-prude. But,
right.
Well, lay out the argument for and against this. What's going on?
Well, here's my thing. I hear a lot, and ever since writing the article, I got a lot of I got a very large response from men and from women. And what I hear a lot is people saying that these women are out there, they're playing sport, they're athletes. There is certainly amount of athleticism that requires to go out there and play. But I think, you know, if they put their clothes back on and they played, I really have to question how many people or how would be showing up to watch them.
Mm.
So what we're doing here, I feel like, is we're making this big murky stew of sports and sex. And, you know, you can have sports and then you have the sex industry, but to call something that nicknamed itself the true fantasy football league a sport, and that people are showing up because of the sport, it's a little ridiculous.
Well,
like,
you know, here's the flip side of that, Megan. Back during the Victorian era in England, when it was
mm-hmm.
not just immoral but illegal for a woman to show more than, you know, an inch or so above her wrist
right.
and even her ankles.
Right. Sure.
The big thing for men to do was to show up at the ballet. Why? Because the women wore costumes that were so skin tight that they might as well have been naked. And
right.
the tutus flipped up high enough, and particularly with some of the turns yeah. and whatnot, that people could catch a shot, you know? And that was the pornography of the era that everybody pretended wasn't pornography. And so
sure.
hasn't this always been with us?
You know, I think as long as we have lived in such a way that we don't have an honest conversation in our society about sex, which we obviously weren't having in the Victorian era either, then yeah, I think this follows us around. I think you see sex pop up in strange places sometimes, because instead of having honest venues for sex in some capacity, whether, you know, it's guys going to a strip club, that almost seems more honest to me, because everyone knows why they're there. No one's trying to hide the reason why they're there.
Yeah. Well,
anytime you have that, yeah, I think it's going to pop up.
This is the interesting thing. I lived in Germany for a year, and Germany was not infected. Continental Europe was not infected by Queen Victoria, as were the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom. And I remember the first week we moved there with our three kids in tow, and Der Spiegel, which is their equivalent of Time or Newsweek magazine, which is on every newsstand, it was an article about a breakthrough in human biology, and there was a picture of a man and a woman holding hands, totally naked, full frontal nudity, on every newsstand in the country, and nobody thought twice about it. A fellow came out to our house to install a washing machine. And Louise walked into the living room to see him standing in the front yard peeing. I mean, I don't know how else to say it on the radio. And you know, she was pretty shocked by that. And he came back in to install the washing machine. And she was like, you know, what are you doing? And he's like, well, I didn't want to, you know, track my dirty shoes into your bathroom. And so,
right.
you know, nobody thinks twice about it. You know, nudity, public nudity in Europe is like, it's like no big deal. But here it's like, we're making a nation of neurotics, and this seems to me like one of the manifestations of that neurosis.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And in the examples you just gave in Europe, like, I think you have a much more, in many circumstances, a much more honest conversation, a much more open conversation happening about sex, which we don't have in this country. And that's why you see this popping up is so popular. I mean, it's the fastest growing women's league in the country. Like the WNBA, that's not it.
Yeah.
is it?
The fastest growing women's league is lingerie football. That's absolutely incredible. And in Europe, you know, they're very, very clear, explicit sex education in the schools, and it's like, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We've got a lot to learn in this country. We've got a lot to unlearn, I think, tragically. And letchildrenplay.com. Let our kids be kids.
That's right. That was my my first website that I started after my son didn't have recess in school. They did away with recess in school.
Oh,
an article for the lingerie football is found on Goodman Project.
Okay, Goodman Project. Great. Thank you,
yeah.
Megan Rosker. Thanks a lot for dropping by.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you. A thought-provoking conversation. There's fastest-growing sport right now. Lingerie football.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, back with that. And what do we do about these corporations? What are we going to do about Wall Street? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you in New York City. I told the story earlier, but in the event that you just tuned in, I know a lot of people kind of cycle through the show as we go through the show. Earlier today, before I came on the air, Louise is here with me in New York, and we were talking with a friend actually, who is the CEO of a New York Stock Exchange listed company. This guy is, you know, doing really well. Thank you very much. And so is his company. And he said, he made this comment that I just thought was so brilliant. He said, you know, first of all, he was sharing how it's, you know, he's part of the 1% and he's as PO'd as the people who are occupying Wall Street, right? As the Occupy Wall Street people. And he said, what's really so wrong is that there was a breaking of the covenant, a breaking of trust with the American people by the banksters on Wall Street. That they broke trust with us. They violated the trust that we gave them, and then, you know, when they got bailed out, they're back to it again. And I can tell you, there's a whole lot of people in this town who are even in the 1% who are saying enough already. You know, in fact, more than enough already. It's time to go. It's time to go the next step. It's time to get beyond this. Aaron in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Aaron, what's up?
I'm doing pretty good, Tom. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What's up?
My thing was this thing about the, I guess it was U.S. Supreme Court ruled that corporations are people.
More or less. The case is Citizens United, and there's some nuance in there, but for all practical purposes, yes. Corporations are people, and money is speech.
Well, I have a question about that. Does that pave the way for slavery? Because according to anti-slavery laws, you can't own people can't own people.
That's right. Here's the contradiction. The 14th Amendment says no person shall be denied equal due process under the law or equal protection under the law. No person shall be denied equal protection under the law. And the corporations argue that because they're artificial persons, that qualifies to them. So therefore, they have all full access to the Constitution. But the 13th Amendment says no person shall own another person. So when a corporation buys another corporation, is that a form of slavery and should they be put in prison for it? What it does, obviously, Aaron, it's a rhetorical question, but it highlights the absurdity of the logic of five men on the Supreme Court. Alito, Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy. It illustrates the absurdity of these five guys. As was pointed out in the dissenting opinion written by Justice Stevens, I strongly urge you to read the dissent in Citizens United that was authored by Justice Stevens, and he just lays it out. I mean, he just lays it right out, and it is solid. Mark in Suffield, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Oh, not much, Tom. I'm doing great. I am one of the top 1%.
Okay.
And good for me. You know what? My life's good. And I'll tell you another thing. I am also a guy who is an investment manager. That's how I make my living.
Okay.
And I will also tell you that the cards are stacked against even people like me when it comes to investments. The hedge funds, computerized trading, you are talking about trades that go in tenths of seconds.
Oh, yeah. The high-frequency traders are the guys who are basically skimming everything off the top.
Absolutely. And what they're doing is they're actually making the job a lot harder for people that actually invest money on behalf of pension funds that aren't in hedge funds.
Right.
And one of the things that I would personally like to see is a 50% tax on any sales or offsetting trades made within a day. Now, the day traders, wow, people make their living that way, fine. Exclude the first 100 grand of income from that. They can make a nice living that way if they want to.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about the things that's going on, the market manipulation, it makes me ill. I'm sitting
why not,
there.
Why not
I'm
just go back to what we had in the United States from the Spanish-American War in the 1898? There was a period where it was dropped in there, I think, just before or after World War II or World War I, but it came back again. And then it came back in 1935 to fund the Securities and Exchange Commission and stayed there until 1964 when LBJ looked at it. And this, it was called the Securities Transaction Excise Tax, STET tax. And it was, as I recall, 0.025% or 0.05%. It was, you know, it was basically a 5 mil tax, right? Or maybe it was 50 mils, but it was this very, very tiny tax on every stock transaction. And, or as a percentage of the, no, it was on every transaction, not as a percentage of the transaction. So, you know, if you were investing for the long run, you wouldn't even notice it, right? I mean,
right,
you're investing a couple million bucks and you're going to sit on it or park it or sit on it for months at a time and you're not churning constantly, you know, it's going to cost you 20, 30 bucks a year. If you're even day trading, it might end up being just a very, very tiny cost to business, $1,000 a year at the most. But if you're doing high frequency trading, it's going to cost you $1 million an hour.
Absolutely. And that takes their incentive away. And another proposal I would like to have, and I toss out there to people because I can't get through to anybody who has any influence, but now I can, is public pension funds, union pension funds are allowing their shares to be shorted. They're making them available for short sales for a pittance. The brokerage houses and the banks give them a few grand a year and say, here you go, look at this. Now we can use your stocks to bet against yourself.
That doesn't work. Yeah.
That's insane.
That is.
And so those, I think if you just did those two things, you'd take a lot of the froth out of the market. You'd see a lot less volatility. And everybody's always whining about, especially the righties, there's just so much uncertainty. Businesses can't hire. Well, businesses, one of the problems is the uncertainty in the financial markets. And if we take that froth out of it, in my humble opinion, it would calm things down. Maybe businesses would start hiring again.
Mark, I absolutely agree with you. Although I think that uncertainty is vastly overrated. The thing that prevents companies from hiring people is that they don't have customers to buy their products.
Exactly. Henry Ford did it right. Pay people more money, then they'll buy more stuff.
That's right.
And I'll tell you another thing, too. Raise my taxes. Okay, if my taxes go up 5%, you know what? I'm not going to live one bit different. I'm going to be happy. I'm happy that I've made it. I was poor. Now I'm not. It's great. And you know what? If I pay more in taxes, that means I've done better. And I'm happy to give back to my country because I'm a patriot.
And it means that, and it means, and if I may, it means that you're living in a society that's healthier. It's like that interview. I think it was on Bloomberg News some months ago where the American reporter was interviewing the German businessman who was himself a multimillionaire, you know, some major industrialist in Germany about something relating to stocks and whatnot. And then it wandered into tax policy. And he said, how much do you pay in taxes? And the guy said, around either 56 or 65%. It was one of those, you know, sometimes you flip numbers back up in your head. But anyhow, it was high. It was over 50%. And the American reporter goes, that's incredible. That's terrible. And the guy says, no. And, you know, so the conversation goes on a little more. And then the American comes back to it. He goes, how can you stand paying that tax? And the guy said, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country.
Thank you. That's great. That's perfect.
Yeah. And that's the mantra that I think anybody who's making over $200,000-$400,000 a year in this country needs to seriously think about. Do you really want? I mean, I worked in India. And have, you know, sat in the hotel or in the airport in Hyderabad. I remember particularly One day I was flying out of Hyderabad, and there was some guy who was coughing his lungs out into the wastebasket. And it was like, if you've ever seen a petri dish, you know, where you put a sample of an antibiotic or an antifungal down, and all of a sudden this circle appears around it where all the bacteria dies off. It was like there was this circle of about a 30-foot radius around this guy where nobody would walk into that circle because everybody knew this guy is coughing his lungs out because he's got tuberculosis, because a third of the population of India has tuberculosis, and 10% of them are active and contagious, and which is a hell of a lot of people. And it's like, do you really want to be a rich man in a poor country? You know, I don't.
That's what the righties say. They say we should look to India and China.
Yeah, right.
You know, China,
right.
A communist, manipulated, controlled economy. We're supposed to emulate them.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you. Mark, right. Thank you very much for the call and for
thank
the very,
you,
very thoughtful call and for listening to WDTW there in Detroit. I appreciate it. Mike in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was just, you'd asked a question about what should we do about Wall Street and, and the banks. I think what we need to do is start taking our money out of our 401ks and our mutual funds and IRAs and stop letting them play with our money. Start putting it in credit unions and municipal bonds.
Yeah, I did that a long time ago. I have no money in a 401k. I have one retirement account with $6,000 in it that I opened years and years ago. Just, you know, my CPA just got all over me and that's it. You know, everything else is like, you know, I don't have to fill out forms or comply. And the thing is that they've rigged the game with 401ks and SEP IRAs and Roth IRAs and things like that so that you basically have to go through the banksters to administer your funds. And you know, they get to take their piece off, and it's just
it's a
rigged game. And I'm not, again, I'm not playing investment advisor, and I'm not telling people what to do with their money. I'm just telling you, I think it's, you know, I'd rather work with after-tax money and, you know, for what there is. And anyhow, Mike, thanks a lot for the call. It is 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here in New York City. It is a moral failing that we are facing right now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And while that moral failing played its way out big time on Wall Street, it's the rules, it's the lawmakers that count.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Tom Hartman here with you in New York City to drop in on Dylan Radigan's program this afternoon. Hopefully he'll have us, and it'll be fun. Kirk in Scranton, Pennsylvania. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Just letting you know, we have an Occupy Scranton, and I wanted to pitch a solution. I'm working on something called the Common Sense Revival, which is critical thinking and positive psychology. So I want to propose that we have an educational equality system in America and that we have critical thinking-based school systems.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the ultimate solution, really, is to get everyone empowered and able to decipher what's propaganda and what's correct
and
factual.
And let's move away from the rote method and move toward the Socratic method of teaching. Absolutely. I'm totally with you. Howard in how do I pronounce the city for me, Howard? Oh, I'm sorry. I just put Todd in Miami, Florida on. Todd, you're on the air.
That's it. Hey, thanks, Tom. Hey, I have a crazy idea. What would happen if the stock exchange were only open one day a week? Let's say it's open on Thursday, and all of the prices are set on Tuesday. So people got two nights to sleep about whether or not they want to buy a stock in any particular company.
Right.
And then they go and they make the trades on Thursday. And then when Thursday the bell rings, people have the whole weekend to decide if the prices were too high or too low.
It's the other end of the teeter-totter from high-frequency trading, isn't it?
The way it works now, imagine going into your grocery store, you pick up an apple and it says it's 10 cents. By the time you walk to the counter, it's 12 cents.
Right, or 8 cents.
That's the way the market works now. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right. Excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Steve in Montpelier, Indiana. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay, good. I just want to make a comment. I appreciate your show. And all those occupiers out there doing a good job and keep it up. point I wanted to bring up here about our deficit and our budget woes that we have is our Defense Department budget. I spent 14 years in the Navy, and one of the main things they teach you in the Navy there is your role is to keep sea lanes free for commerce and traffic. And,
right.
And so out of our defense budget, the corporations and people who export our jobs overseas and bring the stuff back here for us to sell and buy. And
we're subsidizing them.
Seems profitable.
Yeah, we're subsidizing them.
They benefit from our military forces more so than any civilian back here on the ground.
Yeah.
And the only thing that civilians get out is to be able to share their blood, spill their blood for our country. And it seems to me like the Defense Department budget, the majority of it ought to be taxed on the corporations or at least the people who export and import into this country.
Or let's just have a rational conversation about it and say, you know, one of the main things that our Navy does is it keeps our shipping lanes open, and we're importing $1 billion worth of oil a day, and so much of that money is going to the Saudi sheikhs. And, you know, if they want to make sure that it gets here safely, let them field a Navy. Or let's say part of our Navy's cost is going to be paid for by ExxonMobil because, gee, last year they were the most profitable corporation on Earth and they paid no federal taxes. So they paid nothing toward the cost of the Navy that's protecting their ships. So, yeah, I'm totally with you, Steve. Well said. Very well said. Donna in Phoenix, and Howard dropped off. I'm sorry about that. Donna in Phoenix, what's up?
Hi, my other phone's going off, Tom. I had a question because I've gotten mesmerized by a poem by Percy Shelley called The Mask of Anarchy. Are you familiar with it?
I'm not. I'm sorry.
You might want to look at it. Basically, it's dealing with a revolution back in the 1819, actually, he wrote it.
Uh-huh.
And it's about the poor. I thought it was fascinating because it's a pacifist revolution. They refused to fight back against the armies that the British monarchy was sending against.
Where was this?
In England, in 18.
There was a pacifist revolt in England. Oh, against World War One.
No, on 1819.
Oh, 1819.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, and I thought it was fascinating because they've been so good in these Occupy movements about using Gandhi and pacifist.
Right.
Not fighting back on anything. And if you, the poem is an epic poem. It's fairly long.
Okay.
Read it, I think you would really enjoy it. And it's called The Mask of Anarchy.
By Percy Shelley. I'll check it out. Donna, thank you very much for the tip. George in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My wife and I, we're both in our 60s, went to Occupy Santa Fe last Saturday,
mm-hmm.
down in front of the Capitol building,
mm-hmm.
and there are about 250 to 500 people, and most of them, I'd say probably half were, you know, middle-aged or older, and there were a lot of young people there. Everything was very orderly. There were a few police cars, and policemen were just standing across the street.
Yeah.
And the next day, in the local paper, the Santa Fe New Mexican, almost the whole front page was taken up by a human interest story about a stewardess on Pan Am in the 1970s and pushing the Pan Am TV series.
Right.
There was absolutely nothing about this demonstration that was extremely peaceful. I mean, people were having a good time and cars were honking, and we just really wanted to show our support for all the occupiers around the country.
George, I'll bet you $50. Well, I'm not going to bet actually real money on the air, but I think that's illegal. But I'll bet you that that your local paper there in Santa Fe is not owned by a local family or company.
Unfortunately, I don't know who it is owned by.
Yeah.
It may not be, but I could not believe it. The only newspaper reporting it was the Albuquerque Journal, which had a nice article on Sunday with pictures and everything. I mean, and this, we're like 50 miles away from Albuquerque, so they could cover it, but they couldn't get any reporter down, you know, two blocks away from their office to report on this. And I was pretty upset about that.
Yeah. Well, you deserve to be. But here we're live on KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So you just spread the word, George. Thank you for the call. I'm great to hear from you. I'm wondering, you know, if 50% of the people showing up were boomer age, if you asked how many of you have also shown up for a tea party, how many people would raise their hands? That would be a fascinating one. So, you know, I just don't know the answer to that. I just think it would be a fascinating question to ask. Coming up tomorrow, what's the GOP's latest plan to fix Social Security? Oh, this is going to be a doozy. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow back home
in
D.C.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.